Blog Talk Radio.
David, would you like me to send you a picture?
Welcome
just
to
FYI,
different
or
for different folks.
No, we're live,
find
honey.
Common ground and take it to the next level with David Clark here on Blog Talk Radio. Each week, the show will encourage you to keep an open mind and prepare to open the door to new understandings. We will have an exciting array of diverse guests who will point up the fact that we are all spiritual beings having a human experience. Now your host, David Clark.
Welcome to Different Strokes for Different Folks, where we will indeed be finding common ground and taking it to the max level. I'm your host, David Clark. I'm a spiritual adventurer, and I suggest you become the same. When you keep an open mind, you'll come to see that despite our seeming differences, we're all basically the same. You'll also see where you can find common ground so that you can relate rather than compare yourself to others. Now tonight, it's my pleasure to welcome Lisa Loving Dalton. She's a famous former Hollywood stuntwoman. From a bullied, dyslexic, messy, freckle-faced, klutzy pixie, Lisa Loving Dalton grew into a statuesque and skillful stuntwoman, actor, director, teacher, author, filmmaker, leadership life coach, and ceremonial minister. Lisa spent years working with or stunt doubling for a galaxy of celebrity stars, including Madonna, Meryl Streep, Robert Redford, Katherine Hepburn, Sean Connery, Dustin Hoffman, Daryl Hannah, Michelle Pfeiffer, Robin Williams, Cher, and more. She appeared in more than 200 films, television shows, and commercials in New York, Hollywood, and Texas, including work in Ghostbusters, The Money Pit, Crocodile Dundee, Married to the Mob, FX, Legal Eagles, and Splash on the big screen, and on television, ER, HBO's Carnival, Dr. Quinn, and Melrose Place were among her credits. In 1989, Lisa suffered a severe spinal injury that altered her path. To walk and function in chronic pain, Lisa researched medical and alternative paths that form the heart of what she shares with the world today. After her stunt career-ending injury, she resumed her passion to act and teach actors on stage and in film around the world in Russia, Europe, and the Americas. As president of the National Michael Chekhov Association, she mentors teachers in this healthy approach to training. Always seeking and finding the sheer silver lining, she has made the most of whatever life threw at her. She says, "I spill stuff, trip, and drip all the time, so I made a career out of it." Her advice is embrace what is as perfect. What a wonderful, wonderful notion, especially in this day and age when we don't necessarily see things as perfect. So maybe that would be a good starting point. Lisa, how are you tonight?
Well, David, thank you for having me on tonight. I'm excited to chat about my book. I'm absolutely in anticipation about the future of our nation. And so that is definitely a question for all of us to try to hold, and seeing what really is perfect about that. And so I'm curious to find the answer to that question.
And it is so important to find that silver lining, don't you find?
It makes everything tolerable, because if I looked at the things, the pathways that I've taken and that wound up, you know, sort of ricocheting back at me, some of the choices that I've made in my life, some of the things that have happened to me at the hands of others and the environment and the world around us, I could find myself in a deep depression, and then where would I be? So my alternative then is to dig more deeply and call upon my highest powers to look for what's good about this. How can we move forward in any given moment? Whether it's stubbing my toe on a piece of furniture, I can still ask myself, how can I look forward? How can I move from this moment where my body is racked with pain? And what was the message? So when I find that message, then it makes sense. I can find forgiveness.
Well, yeah, all forgiveness is so important. I mean, when you were talking about some of the things that have happened to you that could result in depression, I think oftentimes we can be our own worst enemies, and we beat ourselves up over things that we really didn't know any better. I think we do the best we can each step of the way, and it's so important to be gentle with ourselves and to forgive ourselves and to forgive others too.
I absolutely agree. I'm sure we'll get into talking about my injury, but boy, I certainly had many years to replay that moment and look at all the choices that I made and then some of the things that other people and other circumstances created, and I could have put a whole lot of blame out there, and finding my way through that was definitely part of my healing and growth process.
Well, that's the beautiful thing about life. If we look at each experience that comes our way as a learning opportunity that can facilitate growth, then we are moving in a forward direction. Otherwise, we tend to stagnate. Let's start off with, I'd like to ask you how you ever ended up in the stunt business.
Well, as you mentioned, in the introduction, I really was very, very clumsy and undiagnosed dyslexic, and which sort of, I think, attributed to that sort of spatial disorientation. And that was very painful. And I also happened to be fourth of five children, which left me pretty classically desperate for attention. And my twin brothers were 13 months older than I, which left me feeling very competitive with these boys. I decided somewhere along the line that despite being a klutz, that I should be able to do anything they can do better than they can. So I grew up quite the tomboy, even from kindergarten. I remember being on the top of the jungle gym trying to push one of the boys off, but somehow making sure I had an audience as I did it, which was not very sweet of me. Honestly, just kind of desperate. And but I learned over the years to try to pursue and hone my skill set so that I eventually became a multi-trophied athlete in four sports. And but I always loved being on the stage in some form or another, and that led me to combining the very physical aspects of theater with my athletic prowess, so gymnastics and stage combat and mime, clowning, pratfalls, and things like that. I fell so many times I had to learn how to survive it. So so that's what I did, and I wound up, after I graduated from college, in a very physical theater company in the late 70s in New York called the Bond Street Theater, and I continued to develop all of my athletic and gymnastic acrobatic skills, and when they started touring overseas in 1980, I was freshly married and doing political theater in the regions of danger that they were going into, and by the way, that they still, they're in Afghanistan, they're in Haiti, they're in Myanmar, they are still out there 40 years later putting their lives on the line to educate and uplift people, quite a notable organization. But I was a little more hedonistic at that time. I was ready to try and make a little bit of money at this, and I wanted to get into film. And I had the opportunity to be a stand-in on a movie. You know, a stand-in is a person who stands in the place of the star while the cinematographer and the technicians set up the scene around them. They get the lights ready, the camera ready, the audio ready, and then the stand-in steps away when the star steps into the position and they shoot the scene. So I was hired to double Tina Louise from Gilligan's Island.
Oh, yeah.
You remember Ginger?
Yeah,
so I was a redhead, and I got hired to double Tina, who I had been a big fan of. And on that movie, another character was played by Julie Haggerty. Do you remember Julie Haggerty?
No, I don't.
Yeah, she was in Airplane. In the comedy movies, and she was the sweet stewardess. Oh, Ted!
And yes, now I remember. I just didn't have the name.
In this story, in this movie, she was being kidnapped. And so I spent about 3 weeks in the back of a car being driven by the stunt coordinator and an unknown actor who were playing the kidnappers. And this unknown actor happened to be Ed O'Neill, who became Ted Bundy and who is in Modern Family.
Mm-hmm.
And so I made good friends with them, and I picked the stunt coordinator's brain to understand what stunts were about, and I did ridiculously silly things to try to impress him with my physical prowess, things I'm mortified in an amused way about today, but they worked. We were shooting up in Westchester and upstate New York, and in a very wealthy area where the characters supposedly lived, and a bunch of neighborhood children had gathered around. So I decided to have gymnastic class with the kids so that I could demonstrate to the stunt coordinator that I could do gymnastics. And it seems so silly and so desperate, which I think I truly was at the time, just desperate to try to find my identity and desperate to try and make my way in the movie industry. And it worked, actually. At the end of the shoot, he needed a scene with multiple women in it, and he only had one stunt woman available. And so I got hired. And then he recommended me to somebody, and one thing led to the next. So, yeah, that's how I got into it.
Wow. Well, what kinds of stunts did you do?
Well, I leapt tall buildings. One time it was a six-story rooftops, and I leapt across an alley. That was really, really scary because, man, if you miss... I stood there looking over that ledge, and the alley was too small to put an airbag into, so I'm looking down at one of those little trampolines, like the fireman trampolines that we see in the cartoons. I'm kind of picturing my body ricocheting off the brick walls on its way down and then bouncing back up. So that was exciting. I dodged a train. I jumped off of buildings into airbags and fell downstairs. I got my throat slashed. I got shot. I got drowned. I got punched. I got to crash motorcycles. I got to get hit by cars and crash cars and stuff like that.
Wow. Well, more power to you. That's all I can say. Well, what was scariest of them all? Was it the leaping the building?
I think it was leaping the building because although I had gone to the gymnasium and I'd done my sort of running broad jumps all week long and I was clearing it, it's I don't know. I mean, there is a net down there. I mean, there's a trampoline down there. But what if they miss you? And like I said, what if you ricochet off the building or something? And that was, I mean, when I dodged the train, I scared the heck out of the director because it was so close. But to me, that wasn't as scary as, you know, this leaping across this tall building. That was the most sort of nerve-wracking there. Yeah, I'd say that was it.
Oh. Well, which star did you like working with the most?
I have a tie on that one, and that would be, I think, for very good reasons. Cher, I worked with her on Suspect, and she was just really wonderful to me. A lot of people were really nervous around Cher. They were afraid that she was not going to be happy with things or something like that. And ultimately, I asked one of the makeup artists if they thought it would be okay if Cher and I took a picture together when I was dressed like her. And they were like, oh, no, don't bother Cher. Just do not bother her. You don't want to upset her. And then I was out on the set and Cher and I were hanging out talking. And I said, you know, Cher, would it be okay if we took a picture together? She said, and I pulled out my little brownie camera and she said, oh, I'm going to do one better. And she brought her photographer over and she posed with me for the picture. And then she sent me the autographed 8x10, which was just so generous.
Isn't that gracious?
And it was very gracious. And later on, there was some misogynistic injustice in the production end of things. And when Cher heard about it, she got very upset and she started to stampede off to the producer and the director to tell them that what was, you know, the way I was being treated was absolutely wrong and inappropriate. And she was really going to go to bat for me. And I just grabbed her and I said, you know what, Cher, I understand how this industry is, and I really don't want you to risk your reputation defending me, although I just think you're an amazing woman for uptaking that. But I really had to beg her to not go to bat for me, and because my battle was lost, and she wasn't going to gain anything from it. But just the fact that she was so willing to go to bat for me, I really, really appreciated that. And from the other person that's tied with Cher is the amazing Meryl Streep. And interestingly enough, it was another situation where production was trying to take advantage. They were trying to convince me to do a fall from about 15 feet up onto my belly, to arrange it, to rig it, to set the whole thing up, design it, and do it as an extra instead of on a stunt contract. And I was sitting in makeup next to Meryl, enjoying a wonderful conversation. She's just so down to earth and so lovely and funny, very, very funny woman, and just delightful. When they came in and tried to, you know, talk me out of requiring an appropriate contract, and I was embarrassed that I'm having to defend my rights here and put my life and my body at risk for, you know, $100 instead of a full contract, which at that time was $350 and was residuals and, you know, stuff like that. It's not that it was so much money, but the lack of respect was inappropriate. And so I took the conversation outside. Eventually, I got my contract and I did the job, but Meryl had already left. And when I was getting ready to leave the studio, the makeup artist came over to me and she said, Lisa, wait, I want you to know something. She said, Meryl made sure that you had your contract before she left.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah.
Very nice.
And that, yeah, yeah. So the thoughtfulness of both Meryl and Cher make them my two favorites.
I don't blame you. Well, did you ever experience any kind of discrimination as a stunt woman?
Well, very, very frequently, unfortunately, the first big challenge that arises for women is in order to get into the industry. Certainly at that time in the 80s, most of the women that were in it because they were in a relationship with a stunt man. And so if you were not in a relationship with a stunt man, it was very difficult to get hired. You had to be three times as good, and you had to find a way to prove yourself. And at one point, I was very happily married, and I talked with my husband about the situation, and he knew some of the guys, and he said, you know what, if you feel you need to flirt, you just go for it. I support you 100%, because we had an amazing relationship. So we were both confident. We knew we were both going home together. But at one point, I got cornered in an elevator by one of these guys, and I had to make it very, very clear to him that this was not going to happen, and he never hired me again. And I confronted him 5 years later when I was one of the top three in New York. I confronted him about it, and we continued working together under other people. But I said, you know, why don't you hire me anymore? And he said, well, I've still got your picture in my book, but I don't know. I don't know really what you can do.
Oh,
and I said,
boy.
He was like, you haven't really proved yourself to me. I was like, really? After all the films we've worked on together, all right then. And that's one example. The other is that the stunt coordinators get to choose very frequently who among the stunt players that work on a project will get screen credit. And there's no requirement that the stunt players get screen credit. So most women, if you look on their Internet Movie Database, IMDb.com, if you look on their credits, if they've been very, very aggressive, you'll see a lot of their films listed with the parenthesis uncredited next to it. And that's because, A, they weren't listed in the film at all, and they've had to go into IMDb and plead to be listed, and then they have to be listed as uncredited, as if they never did the work, because the men are mostly the ones who are hiring each other, and therefore they're going to give the perks to the people who can hire them back. So many times the stunt women go uncredited.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it's... I hope it's better now. I mean, I think films are giving credits to more people. But I just saw a movie the other day with a bunch of the Ghostbusters. I was in the original Ghostbusters, so I went and saw the new Ghostbusters, and they had, you know, 800 people listed in the graphics area, and they had about a dozen stunt players listed. And I was like, why are there only a dozen stunt players listed? You mean to tell me that all those stunts were done by 12 people? So, you know, I don't know how all that's working, because even when stunts today are generated by character generation, painted in, if you will, there are stunt players that are hired to actually be the models for the graphics generators. So the stunt players have a whole new field of employment working in green screen environments. So they're still working.
Well, let's move forward in time a little bit. Tell us about the injury, what happened, and how that affected you.
Yeah, well, as the same time I started my stunt career, I became aware of an acting technique that was very healthy and very physically oriented, and I was training and growing in power with that at the same time as I was growing in my reputation as a stunt woman. And the more I knew about this spiritually centering acting approach, more healthy I became emotionally, spiritually, psychologically, and I started to realize that I really wasn't supposed to be a stunt woman. That just because I was moving into the top of that group didn't mean that's where I was supposed to be. But I had gotten so caught in the ego of it and the whole sort of excitement and everything that I kept doing it. And finally, after 7-8 years, I said, I must stop. And I relocated to Los Angeles. I removed stunts from my resume. I started from scratch as an actress. But I flew back 37 times to New York because I just couldn't say no. And I couldn't walk away from the income. And I was scared. And finally, my husband just begged me to trust in my choices and trust in the messages I was given. I actually had 3 friends over 4 months, 3 highly skilled stuntmen who were killed in needless injury accidents on the sets. And that was a huge message, and I ignored it. And finally, I said, okay, I'm not doing it anymore. I waited 6 months. I said, I don't need to keep an apartment in New York. And so I flew back to hire movers. And the night before I left, my friends called me up and said, oh, Lisa, we love you. We need you. You're the only one who can do this. It's a rappelling thing. It's very easy. And, you know, it's $431. And it'll be, you know, it'll pay for your airfare. And you're going to be here anyway. And the girl who was going to do it is going to be in L.A. So, you know, you must be destined to do this. And I bought into it. And it was a simple rappelling off a cliff, you know, a high cliff, but I was only going to be dropping down to a ledge about 25 feet down. And it was December 7th. And it was very, very cold over the Palisades cliffs above the George Washington Bridge. And I flew in at night, the night before, and I practiced on a pier, on the elevator shaft of the pier where this production studio was, dropping down 5 stories off this elevator shaft, getting familiar with their particular equipment, which had a thicker rope than I was used to rappelling with. So it was slower. You had to sort of push harder and hold out more to get the slide going. And so I got the hang of that. And when they brought me into wardrobe, the wardrobe people had not been told that I was going to be the stunt double instead of the gal who'd flown to L.A. And the gal who'd flown to L.A. was much smaller than I was. I was the same size as the actress who was Allie Walker. And she's currently sometimes the love interest on Longmire, and she was in the FBI show Profiler. Mm-hmm. And so Allie was the star of this new series called True Blue, about the New York Emergency Services. So I was going to double her with her partner, who was John Bolger, and his stunt double and I were going to drop down off this cliff that was kind of on a promontory. So it kind of jutted out into the gorge. And so I was the same size as her, but the pants that the people had, customers had, were very small and I couldn't fit into them. And I said, no problem, because I have New York police pants at home, because I played that many times. And I went back to my apartment at 1 o'clock in the morning, had a 7 a.m. call, and tried to find my New York pants, and I could not. And I found my New Jersey police pants, which had a baby blue stripe instead of a black stripe. 3 o'clock in the morning, I took the only thing I could find that was black, which was a thin point Sharpie, and I spent 2 hours making the blue stripe black. 5 o'clock in the morning, I went to sleep for an hour and a half, and 7:15, I was on the set, freezing, unrested, unfocused, ready to go. About 7:45, we're standing on top of this promontory. They're trying to get four cameras going at once, and the wind is blowing, and we can't move because they're focused on us. And after about 10 minutes, they finally can't get anything going. They say, stop. Just go back to your trailer. We're going to do this after lunch. So I go back. I take my gear off, my padding off. I lie down. I take a nap. 20 minutes later, they come knocking on the camper door and say, we're going now. We're going. And I'm in a complete daze. I might have been fine if I hadn't gone to sleep for 20 minutes. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I just remember standing at the top of the ledge saying to myself, keep your legs up, you're tired, give a lot of slack to the rope, make sure your legs are up when you come back to the, you know, when you push off and come back to the cliff edge. Going to take just 2 steps down, then I'm going to do a nice big push off and slide on down and rescue the fallen hiker that's on this ledge, which is actually a dummy. So finally, after what seemed interminable wait, we went, and when I pushed off, I gave that extra push, and the rope slacked and slipped
off the
corner.
Mm-mm.
And the rope was actually anchored all the way at the base, which was 25 feet back, so I remained in place on the rope, but the rope gained 25 feet and ricocheted me back and forth repeatedly between the walls of the cliff, and crashing my head and back and spinning. And ooh, as soon as I got stable, there was a tree kind of jutting out from the, and I grabbed a hold of it and got stable. And said right then and there, this will be the most spiritual gift I will ever give myself. And it truly was.
Mm. Wow.
It was quite a shock. And from there, I don't know if this is probably not in the PR or anything, but one reason why I had these New Jersey police pants was because I was a special sergeant with the Englewood, New Jersey Police Department. And I was taken to the Englewood, New Jersey Hospital, which was a little embarrassing, by my favorite ambulance driver who had been on many, many sets with me. And I remember him saying to me, as we were in the ambulance, he said, I never thought I would be driving you in this vehicle. You'll be back. You'll be up again. And I went, no, this was the last. I'm done. And everyone at the hospital said I was fine. I had a little minor concussion. Over the next 5 days, I cleared out 2,000 pounds, literally a ton of things I didn't want to move to California. And I know that because I had an estimate the next day, and then the guy came back to move me, and it was 2,000 pounds lighter.
Wow.
But during that time, I developed a huge hematoma, a giant blood blister on the small of my back. It was so big, it looked like someone took a soda can and slipped it under my skin.
Wow.
And they had to fly me home in first class on my stomach because I couldn't lie or sit. Mm-hmm. And the doctors in L.A. said there was nothing wrong with me, that the hematoma would reside on its own. 2 months later, it hadn't changed. And but I had gotten acupuncture approved by the work comp company after 8 people on the same day who didn't know each other recommended the very same acupuncturist in L.A., and I took that as a good sign. And I was right there in the office when, between Christmas and New Year's, the work comp approved it. I heard it over the speakerphone with the doctor and the receptionist. And for the next 3 months, I started with, first 6 weeks, I had 5 days a week with Dr. Watanabe, and then 3 days a week. And after 3 months, the workman's comp informed Dr. Watanabe's office that they weren't going to pay a single penny, that they'd never approved it.
Oh, my.
Apparently some temporary person there during the holidays approved it, and they refused to acknowledge that. Well, Dr. Watanabe was kind enough to accept whatever my SAG and AFTRA union health care paid him, but I was out of money. I was unemployed and couldn't afford anything else, and I'd used up all my benefits. So instead, work comp sent me to 2 weeks of traditional therapy and got me where I could sit for almost 5 minutes on a stationary cycle, and said I was perfect and should go on. Now, I was a top-level athlete here. I was in extraordinary shape at the time, and so I went to a personal trainer, and after 2 months, my knees and my wrists went out so badly I couldn't even write. I couldn't hold a pencil, and I couldn't walk. So I stopped exercising because exercise made it worse. And by December, I was completely bedridden. I couldn't function. I couldn't walk. I called the studio, and they got me a new doctor. And I went to that doctor, and I camped out in his office. I was there for 6 hours. He kept trying to get me to leave, telling me there was nothing wrong with my x-rays. I looked fine, and suggesting, you know, that it was mental and that it was my imagination. And it's like, it's not my imagination when I take 3 steps and suddenly I'm on the ground. That's not my imagination. And he sent up security, some big security guy, and I said, you better get 2 more guys because I'm not leaving. I'm camped out until somebody tells me what's wrong. Finally, the doctor decided to take x-rays of me bent over and arching. And the split second he saw the films, he said, oh, that's you. You're in a lot of pain. Oh, you have a permanent disability here.
Yeah,
he said the problem was that the vertebra are unstable and they move out of position all the time. They keep changing positions, grinding away the discs and crushing the nerves, and you know, sometimes pinching the central spinal nerve. And he said, go back to the first 2 guys he saw, tell them what we did, have them do their own, and we will all concur, and we will all tell the work company this is a permanent disability. And all 3 of them separately said, you better fight for lifetime care and delay any surgery until you absolutely can't function. And so the good part was I was finally validated,
sure.
You know, that there was a problem. The tough part was that there was going to be no solution provided by the medical system. So here I was go ahead.
Where did you turn?
Well, I started with the yoga and the and voice dialogue, interestingly enough, the process of identifying your sub-personalities and meditation, so that I had to identify the parts of me that were so angry. I don't know, David, if you've ever have an ache in your body, or hear people say, "I have a bad back," or "I have a bad knee," or "I have, you know, a bad elbow," something like that.
Sure.
And I learned that, you know, I got this wonderful image of these poor little cells being criticized by my brain constantly, being accused repeatedly of being bad, bad, bad. And all they were doing is what they are divinely designed to do, which is to seek homeostasis. They're trying to heal, and they're getting messages from me accusing them of hurting me, accusing them of being bad. And so I had to sort of change my languaging to call my back a healing back, to thank those cells, to thank those pain signals, because they were telling me that I needed to adjust my body to relieve the crushing that was happening on the nerves there. And I learned hypnosis, and I learned neurological repatterning, and deeper into yoga. And I was able to get a very good physical therapist that WorkComp did pay for, who gave me a lot of core stabilizing exercises, and began the process of forgiving myself, forgiving the rope, forgiving the earth. I literally went out to mountainsides and laid my flesh against the rock, and you know, spoke and prayed and meditated with the earth to forgive myself for turning that blue stripe black, for taking a nap, for not noticing that the rope could have been anchored, had an extra eye hook right near the edge that would have kept it from slipping over. Or I could have said no thank you and not done the job. You know, there were many, many choice points that I had missed out on, and I sought to work my way through those, and I went into, I was in Los Angeles, so I had access to an emerging doctor, scientist guy named Deepak Chopra, who was giving little lectures at UCLA for 50 people, you know, and I was there. And I learned about the HeartMath Institute. Are you familiar with them?
Yes.
Yes. So they had a program, Freeze Frame, where you understand that 5 minutes in a state of frustration and anger will lower your immune system for over 6 hours, and 5 minutes in a state of appreciation will boost it for over 6 hours. So I started using that Freeze Frame, freezing the frame on those negative thoughts and imagining positive and healthy things. And each one of these things that I learned happened to actually align with the acting technique that I had begun teaching. And I was able to then become a better teacher, because all of this energy management that I was ultimately becoming a master of in order to walk and function in life was also enabling me to explain this formerly obscure approach to acting to people, and that's what really took me to Moscow and Paris and Brussels and Berlin and London and places like that. So it was quite a journey.
It sure sounds it, my goodness. Well, you've written a book called Falling for the Stars, A Stunt Girl's Tattletales. What's the message in the book that you wanted to get across to your readers?
There were a couple of messages. I mean, one, the book is really fun. It's kind of a rollicking roller coaster of really funny things that happened, delightful things like the Cher and the Meryl stories, some of the scary things like the deaths, and my injury. But with each episode, and there's about 40 some episodes, I learn something, and I share that, whether it's confronting my insecurities, my doubts, when I finally learned to take a stand for myself, and a couple of times I did say, no, I'm not going to do that. And so the lessons I learned, I'm hoping that when people read it, that they have fun. I mean, there's a crossword puzzle, there's poetry, there's a sort of smart alecky dictionary of film terms in there, and that along the way people see some of the same things that everyone runs into on any given day of their life, and how they can either not do what I did when it wasn't such a great idea, or model some of the healthier choices that I did make. So keeping in mind that entertainment can be healing, I really want people to be entertained by it, to laugh and giggle and stuff like that. But I do, as I said, hope that people will not need to crash themselves into a cliff to get onto their right path.
Really?
Yeah.
Where's the best place for people to get your book?
My book is, it's been a number one bestseller on Amazon, so it's available there, and also at my website, which is lisadalton.com. And there's actually some free chapters on lisadalton.com, along with some links to some various videos and pictures in color. And there's my blog that has more stories about how I've used the lessons from stunts to address everyday fears and help us get past some of the things that hang us up. Some funny things along with it. So I also have workshops, and there's information about the workshops there as well. So lisadalton.com is a great place to visit, and Amazon has the book both in ebook and paperback.
Well, tell us about your workshops.
I am president of the National Michael Chekhov Association, and that's this healthy, freeing approach that is great for actors, teachers, directors. But I also have life coaches and doctors and nurses and people of all walks of life who come to explore how to express themselves more fully and freely. And I also have workshops in that I custom create. I travel sometimes with a one-woman show that I do to speak at places, perform, and do some of these application of these acting techniques for human health and development. So ways to get yourself to feel better through some of these acting techniques. And on my website, there's a YouTube link to my YouTube channel, which has a 10-minute video on conflict resolution. So people can go there and see sort of how that works. And the workshops can be anywhere from, you know, a 3-hour masterclass into like our full week-long program coming up at the University of Florida, December 27th to January 2nd. And again, in New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, June 4th to June 11th. So that's a little bit about my workshops.
Beautiful. Well, I'd like to explore the spiritual dimension a little bit more. Of course, you've talked a lot about spiritual techniques that you used in order to obtain some healing in your life, and you sound remarkably well healed at a spiritual and emotional level. I don't know what your body is like today, but you've described yourself as having had an atheistic ego and being a fear-driven woman when you were younger. And how did you turn that around into being the person that you are today?
I had grown up as a Catholic and was very devout and loved ritual. I was disillusioned when the Catholic Church went from Latin into English, because this sort of magic had disappeared for me. And as I got into high school, and then when these things happened to me, the disillusionment of college, and I had wound up in college so disillusioned, I lived with an abusive alcoholic for 4 years. My esteem was very, very deeply challenged. And I think part of what drove me to, you know, try to be a top stunt woman was just sort of to prove that I had some sort of power and strength, in a sort of delusional way in many regards, but that finding one of my theater colleagues from Bond Street Theater who introduced me to the I Ching. And the I Ching was astonishing to me, throwing these coins or sticks and asking questions, meditating on questions, opening a book written thousands of years ago and having answers given to you. The answers were so remarkably spot on that it was the first inkling that there must actually be something, because I had hit this, you know, if there was a God, God would never allow this man to be beating me up right now. God would never allow my girlfriend to be raped. God would never allow this, you know, X, Y, Z, these series of things that I'd seen to happen. But now I was saying to myself, there must be something. And in that search for something else, finding the sense of inner power as I grew in the acting technique invites us to be aware of a power within us that is connected to a higher source that has access to all that is. And one imagines these radiant beams of force coming into you and flowing out of you, radiating and receiving. And I started to see people being actually transformed through this energy power work. And I could see I could enter a room and I could change the vibration of the room all by myself. I could walk in and make a room that was filled with tension turn into a room of sunlight that other people would feel and not know why. And I started to see there's something beyond our own body, and it can travel through space, and it can come from space, and it can be space. And when I got deeper into meditation, I could feel myself completely disappear and merge. And all time would stop. And this was the same kind of experience that a performer has when you're in the zone, that time stops and space disappears and there's no sense of separation. And when I was in these kinds of states, I felt no need to prove anything to anybody. I knew that not only is there divine force, but that I am that I am. I am part of that. Every cell in my body, which I realized I'd actually been kind of angry, not just about being a woman and limited to a woman's body, but I'd kind of been hung up on having to have a body, you know, trying to leap tall buildings as if I didn't have a physical body that could get hurt. I suddenly realized now I get to play with the goal of spiritualizing my physical form and leading others to spiritualize their form, that the body has evolved over eons of time with this incredible self-healing ability, this ability to manifest and transform energy, to affect each other and to be affected by. And what an amazing gift. How amazing is that, that we can collaborate as human beings and support each other, uplift each other, care for each other, because we are each other in that regard. So
absolutely.
My arc, my growth from that really very atheistic, very, live for today, hedonistic. David, I had a wall that was 15 feet long. It had 5 shelves of high-end cowboy boots. Because when I wanted a new pair of boots, I hopped on my motorcycle and I rode from New York to El Paso if I wanted, bought myself a few new pairs and shipped them home.
Oh my.
I was making a lot of money at the time and I could buy whatever I wanted. And it still wasn't making me happy. So I was at least smart enough, because I was really happy in my acting classes as I was learning this technique. I was smart enough to recognize that there was more than money, there was more than fame, there's more than physical prowess. And boy, when you wind up, unemployed and crippled, you learn.
I'm sure. Well, we're winding up, and I'd like to ask you what role gratitude has played in your life, and what are the things you're most grateful for?
Gratitude is so central to my life. It's something that I begin with when I wake up, to wake up. I lost my husband 7 years ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And thank you. It was very traumatic. He had a heart attack while going, while riding his bike, his motorcycle in front of me. We were in the hills of Arkansas, and he went off a cliff. And it was very traumatic. And, David, it was how he had told people for over 25 years that he wanted to go when it was his time.
Mm-hmm.
And that was remarkable. Stunt gal called me up. I hadn't heard from her in 26 years. And she called me up and said, I remember having dinner with him and him telling us when it was his time, he was not going in a hospital. He was going on his motorcycle and he was going to go off a cliff. And that, I'm grateful for that every day that I was riding on my motorcycle behind him, because I saw his head and his arm go into spasms, and I saw him drift like an angel, just float across the road and off the cliff. And if I had been in front, as I had been riding and leading for most of the 3 days before, I never would have known, was it a tire? Was it, something he did? Was it a driver? What was it? So the gratitude allows me to cope with a lot of the trauma and tragedy. The gratitude helps give purpose for each event in my life. And wow, I have been so blessed with the home that he made sure I was in, a home where I could live and be taken care of. Gratitude is very important.
Well, God bless you.
Thank you.
Well, I thank you so much for coming on this today.
Thank you. I'm really grateful for getting a chance to talk with you.
It's been my pleasure, and I think you underscored one of the most important things that we can all possess, and that is a grateful heart. And to remember in so doing that we're connecting with our love essence, and there's nothing more important in the world than that, I believe.
It's true. And my husband was so with me, that his spirit was so with me in writing this book. And he really wanted it. He wanted it.
Beautiful story. That's beautiful. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I look forward to listening to more of your shows.
Oh, well, that's sweet. And I will tell you, in fact, I'll call you after the show and tell you how to download this episode onto your website.
Fantastic. That's absolutely fantastic. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Get more people to listen to your show, and we'll move on from there.
Sounds good. Okay, well, once again, we come to a close. Now let's pause and reflect upon the idea that we are all united through the diverse tapestry of our individual gifts. There is no real thing as separation except in our own minds. We are each unique expressions of the ultimate source of our beings. We are spiritual beings having a human experience who can and will have a spiritual experience if we let it be. Have a great week, and remember, whatever you dream, you can realize. Good night and God bless.